Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are talking about the state of the U.S. economy. Today's guest, economist Dean Baker, says, don't expect a recession next year. In a piece for Truthout, he writes that over the last four decades, we have seen a large shift in the economy from areas that are highly sensitive to the business cycle to areas that are not. And for this reason, it seems unlikely that we will see a sharp enough fall in demand in the highly cyclical sectors to lead to a recession. He also writes, to be clear, this hardly means that the economy faces smooth sailing. There are a wide variety of indicators showing the economy is slowing. The 3% growth promised by Donald Trump following his tax cut is looking like a bad joke. Today, we will also discuss trade. It has been more than a year since the world's two largest economies, the U.S. and China, embarked on an ongoing trade war. In a piece for Jacobin, Dean Baker writes that on trade policy, the media has a simple rule. When trade hurts the working class, it's good for the economy. When it hurts the ruling class, it's bad for the economy. Dean Baker is a senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which he co-founded in 1999. He's a visiting professor at the University of Utah, and he writes commentary on economic reporting for his Beat the Press blog. He is the author of 10 books, including his most recent, Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And Dean Baker joins us from Utah. Hi, Dean. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Great to have you back. Well, since Donald Trump has taken office, one of his major talking points has been that the U.S. economy is booming like never before. He talks about record unemployment rates and a healthy job market. And we often hear about how the stock market is booming and the jobs that the U.S. economy continues to gain. What do you think about this, the way that this is framed, Dean?
Well, it's a mixed story. The economy is in good shape in a lot of ways. It's a continuation of the Obama recovery. So the idea that somehow Trump turned the economy around is, by really any measure, nonsense. But it has continued to grow. The unemployment rate is down. 3.7% is the best we've seen since the late 60s. We are seeing some wage growth, even at the middle and bottom of the wage distribution. So that's a good story. Particularly, the most disadvantaged groups tend to benefit from a low unemployment rate. So African Americans, the unemployment rate we've been seeing, it jumps around month to month, but we had seen the lowest on record. African Americans do seem to be seeing some decent wage growth. We're hearing reports because of labor shortages that employers are looking to hire people they might not have otherwise, including people with criminal records, which again is a great thing. So in a lot of ways you could say the economy is pretty good. How much of that is attributable to Trump? I think the answer is very, very little. I mean, the tax cut he gave did give a temporary boost to the economy, nowhere near as much as he and his economists had predicted. And also, it seems like it's petering out very quickly, as I think most of us had expected. So basically, what we saw with his tax cut was that it primarily went to shareholders. They spent much of it. But having done that, we're now falling back into kind of the pre-tax cut growth rates, 2.1% in the last quarter, and we certainly have not seen the promised investment boom. Investment actually fell in the last quarter. So long and short, I think it is a pretty good economy. Whether it will stay that way is an open question, but for now at least, we could say most people are benefiting from the growth of the last two or three or four years.
How do you determine the overall health of the economy? What factors do you look at?
Well, certainly, you know, for most people, what they care about is what are job prospects. So is the unemployment rate low? One of the issues many of us have looked at coming out of the Great Recession was that even though the unemployment rate was getting lower, we still noticed there were a lot of prime-age workers, these are people 25 to 54, who were not working or looking for work. And that was something that bothered many of us because it wasn't clear whether that was because for whatever reason people decided they didn't feel like working, or alternatively, simply they didn't bother looking for work because they didn't think there were jobs there. So we look at the employment rates, and the good story there is those employment rates have started to tick back up. So for some groups, for example, for women in that age group, it's actually somewhat above the pre-recession level. But for men, it's still somewhat below, although it has been rising. So we look at that. You look certainly at wage growth. I mean, most people, most of their income is wages. So you like to see that workers are getting their share of productivity gains. That certainly wasn't true during the Great Recession and the years immediately following it. But as the labor market has started to tighten, say, the last 4 years, workers have been sharing in the gains of productivity growth, seeing wage gains. Other issues, you try to see that it's balanced. One of the things that I and at least some other people were looking at back in the last recovery was that it was very unbalanced, that we had this huge housing bubble that was really driving the economy. And many of us were concerned, unfortunately not enough, or at least not enough people in the right places, that that was going to end badly because bubbles tend to burst. And, of course, that did end badly. So you try to see that it's balanced growth. And by most measures, the current economy is looking pretty good. I mean, again, the unemployment rate's low, wages are rising up and down the wage distribution, and there's no real evidence of bubbles anywhere. Well, I should caution that, qualify that. There's no evidence that bubbles are driving the economy. So Bitcoin, that could have a bubble. I don't know. I'm commenting on it. I don't know any Bitcoin and probably wouldn't want to. But in any case, if Bitcoin's prices fell to zero, that wouldn't sink the economy. So we don't have a story where we could talk about the housing bubble in the last decade or the stock bubble in the 1990s driving the economy so that if there was a serious correction of that bubble, it would cause serious economic damage.
In a recent post for the Washington, or a recent piece for the Washington Post, you cite research from the Economic Policy Institute, and it found that CEO pay has risen 940% since 1978, while typical worker pay has risen only 12% during that time. So you've got CEOs at the top 350 firms last year making an average of $14 million a year, or more than $17 million when you factor in stock options, and the average worker makes $58,000 a year. And I wanted to ask you about how that affects the economy, but to go a little deeper, in 2017, the Washington Post reported that half of all jobs in the U.S. pay less than $18 an hour. And so if that's your full-time job and you're making $18 an hour, that's $37,000 a year.
Yeah, so this leads to a very unbalanced economy, and we've seen this massive gain in pay for those at the top, CEOs being the most obvious example, but you see it, a lot of the hedge fund people get paid even higher, hedge fund private equity partners, so you can find examples of people getting even higher pay, and those at the middle and bottom have seen very little by way of wage gains over really the last four decades. So we've had this very unbalanced economy where most of the benefits of growth have gone to those at the top. And that's very disconcerting. And, you know, the basic data is not really in dispute in that sense. So it's not as though we have to argue about who's gotten the gains. That's pretty clear. We have enough ways to measure that we could say that with some degree of certainty. But the big question is why. And, you know, the CEO pay, when my friends, I used to work at the Economic Policy Institute, so these are my friends there, when they did that, you know, of course, it's quite striking when you see the numbers, but the question is, okay, is this because CEOs are somehow hugely more productive in 2018 than they were, say, 40 years ago? And that's the sort of thing that I don't think anyone could say with a straight face. That's really true. What's happened is we've seen, I would say, at least a corruption of the corporate governance process so that the pay of CEOs is determined largely by corporate boards, and people get on corporate boards primarily because of their friends or associates of the CEOs or other top management. So they have no problem if they're on the board of, you know, some huge company with billions of dollars in profits. They don't see any problem with paying the CEO $14-17 million, because why not? The CEO's their friend, their associate. The money's there. Why not give it to them? There's no idea. No one says, I've raised this, not that I know that many people on corporate boards, but sometimes do come across them and say, well, does anyone say, you know, can we get a CEO that's as good for half the price? And invariably, they think I'm joking. And you go, well, isn't that your responsibility as a board member to make sure that you're not overpaying the CEO and top management? And that almost, it's like I'm speaking nonsense to them. But in principle, that's supposed to be their responsibility. But corporate governance is such that if a board member gives the CEO too much money, they'll never get in trouble for that. Almost none of them are ever removed by shareholders. the only way a board member ever loses their job is if they piss off other board members. So for a board member to start to say, hey, our CEO's really not that good, we shouldn't be paying them $14 million, we could get someone who's just as good for half the, you'll probably piss off the other board members and you might find yourself losing your job there. So we basically have a story of a corruption of corporate governance that leads to this very high pay, and it's not just for CEOs, because if a CEO gets $15 million, odds are the chief financial officer is getting $8, $9, $10 million. The next tier of corporate executives might be getting $2 or $3 million. So it's a lot more money for those at the top, and that means less money for everyone else. So that's not the whole story of upward redistribution of the last four decades, but that's a striking part of it.
And can you help us understand, Dean, where does this all go? Because when you really dig deep and read about people who have multiple jobs, according to the census, about 8% of the population has more than one job. Women are more likely to have more than one job. The Washington Post focused on a woman in Seattle, Laura Milliken, who got her college degree back in 2014. And she's still piecing jobs together, 30 hours a week as an assistant property manager and then a few extra hours at a college. Those two jobs together pay her just $25,000 a year. Okay, so you've got that. And then just to add a couple more stats to this, The Guardian had a good piece recently about how so many older people cannot make ends meet at this point, and they're finding the numbers are going up. And then one more statistic for this is half of families have no retirement account savings at all. So how do you factor all of that in? And when you look at where people are in terms of struggle, especially as they get older, what are your thoughts about where we will be in 5, 10, 15 years?
Yeah, there's a lot of very disturbing parts of the picture. So in addition to the fact that people's wages aren't growing, we've seen just a collapse of traditional defined benefit pensions. So if you go back 2-3 decades, most people in middle-class jobs had a defined benefit pension. Mm-hmm. So you could look forward to not only your Social Security, but a pension. We could say it wasn't overly generous, because in most cases it wasn't. But if you could count on, in addition to Social Security, say $25,000, $30,000 in pension income, that makes a huge difference. And that's not going to be true for workers that are retiring 5, 10 years out. We know that the percentage of the workforce, particularly outside the government, that has a defined benefit pension is just falling through the floor. They're beginning to be very, very rare. So that means, what do they have by way of retirement income, 401ks? For the most part, not very much. Again, we have good data on that, most people, you do have maybe the top 20% have a decent amount of money accumulated in a 401k, but many people don't even have access to one at their workplace, and most people, when they do, they're not in a position to put in very much money. So they're facing very poor retirement prospects. This has been a big debate, which I've been in the middle of over the last few years, that it seems current retirees have been doing better than we previously realized. There was new analysis that came out from the census that showed we're missing a lot of income, and that's certainly a very, very big deal. But the next part of the story, that many of the people saying that, oh, things are much better than we thought, what they missed was most of the income that wasn't getting counted was income from defined benefit pensions. So it wasn't as though we had all these retirees who had $200,000 socked away in a 401k that for whatever reason it wasn't being picked up. That wasn't what was going on. We had people that for whatever reason we weren't getting their pension income. But as that becomes, as we get to a situation where people don't have pensions, that's moot. So we're going to see many more people that hit retirement age with nothing but their Social Security, and that's going to be a problem for them. And, you know, again, as you were saying before, in many cases, of course, they struggle through their working years. The two-job story, that is a big problem. Again, it's not altogether a new problem, because we've had a lot of people working multiple jobs for a long time. But we do find people more insecure in their jobs, and also they're less likely to have benefits in their jobs. As I was talking a moment ago about pensions, but of course, health care is also huge. Many fewer workers have health care through their workplace. The Affordable Care Act has been somewhat of an aid in that respect, in that people can get health care through the exchanges or through Medicaid, but still, health care is a huge, huge expense and huge, huge concern for tens of millions of people.
The Washington Post recently ran a headline, "Income inequality is rising so fast, our data can't keep up." Given that you closely watch economic media. You monitor how the media report on the economy, Dean. As you say, it's a mixed bag because, yes, there are jobs out there. But how do you think the media are really showing the complexities of this, that the economy is working very well for some segments of the population, and it's not working well for other segments of the population?
Well, I think they actually are doing a much better job, and I've been following media reporting on the economy closely for more than a quarter century, and I think they are doing a much better job than they did in prior decades. So there, if you pick up one of the major news outlets, we're talking about the Washington Post, you pick up the Washington Post, New York Times, it's very frequent that they have a comment about income inequality or difficulties of ordinary workers, and that was much, much rarer, say, 20, 25 years ago. So in that sense, they've done much better. Now, some cases, there are some places they certainly haven't improved much. So the emphasis on the stock market, it kind of drives me nuts that if you just get one piece of news on the economy in a day, invariably it's what happened with the S&P 500, the Dow Jones Index. And that's really not telling you much about the economy. That's telling you what's going on if you hold a lot of stock, which, you know, for better or worse, is not most people. Most of us don't have a lot of money in the stock market. So that isn't really that important information in terms of how the economy's doing. But that does get a huge amount of emphasis in economic reporting. And it's really, it's important to understand. I mean, the stock market, even by design, I'm not making some sort of left-wing critique of the stock market, even by design, it's not supposed to tell you about the economy. Wages going up, that isn't going to affect the stock market, at least not directly. The stock market's supposed to be the value, or I should say expected value, of future corporate profits. So if it looks like profits are going to be higher at GE and Microsoft and other big companies, that's going to cause the stock market to go up. Doesn't mean that growth will be higher, and certainly doesn't mean that wages will be higher. It just means that people are expecting profits of those companies to be higher.
Today we're speaking with Dean Baker, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which he co-founded in 1999. He's also visiting professor at the University of Utah. And today we are talking about the real state of the U.S. economy and what we can expect in the coming years. If you have any questions for Dean Baker, we'd love to hear from you. If you have felt any changes in the last couple years, give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's talk a little bit about consumer spending, Dean. Consumer spending is the greatest driver of the economy, around 80%. Can you talk about that and what that means exactly?
Well, it's very hard to tell a story where the economy is doing well and consumers are not spending. So consumer spending does prop up the economy. Now, it tends to be the case that from quarter to quarter, consumer spending doesn't change that month, or month to month, if you prefer. So general story is people spend most of the money they get. Now, that's not true at the very high end. Bill Gates is of the world. They have a lot of money that they're not spending. But for most middle-income people, and particularly poor people, they're spending most of the money they make. Now, where there is some variation is when you think of big ticket items. So buying a new car, or if you want to replace a major appliance or a refrigerator, something like that, people have some choice in general, at least, as to when they're going to do it. I mean, if your car breaks down and you need it for work, you probably have to do something. But for the most part, people have some choice on that. And that really does depend on their outlook on the economy. So many people, and I try to avoid giving financial advice, but people say, oh, I was thinking of getting a house. Is this a good time? And so the simple advice I feel comfortable giving is, well, you don't want to do something like that unless you're fairly certain about your job prospects. So if you've been an employer for 10 or 15 years and it's a large company that's not likely to go out of business or anything, then, yeah, you probably don't have to worry. On the other hand, you just got a job, the company's not that large and that stable, you don't know if there's a downturn, whether you might be on the list for a layoff, you might say, well, you may want to hold off on buying a new car or getting a new house, committing yourself to a big payment. So that's something that does vary over the course of a business cycle, so that when people are fearful about their economic prospects, we see less spending on these big ticket items, and that can have a negative impact on the economy. And of course, when people are feeling good, you know, they feel the economy is healthy and likely to stay healthy, they feel more comfortable making those sorts of purchases. So that's kind of the big fluctuation in consumer spending that we'd see.
Let's talk about trade. And before we discuss the piece you wrote for Jacobin called How the Media Fools Us About Trade, I mean, we can have an entire hour conversation just on trade. But can you talk about how some of these trade policies, say, over the last couple decades, have really affect workers who made a good living with good benefits in the U.S.?
Well, really, a very central focus of trade policy has been to make it as easy as possible for companies to move production overseas, whether it be to Mexico, to China, and then bring back their output to the United States, sell what they produce back in the United States. And when you hear people talk about the trade deficit, particularly Donald Trump, they talk about it, oh, we had stupid trade negotiators, China really took them, this and that. That wasn't the case at all. This was what they were trying to do. They were, I don't mean to say they wanted a huge trade deficit, but they wanted to make it easy for a General Electric, for a Boeing, whoever it might be. They wanted to make it easy for them to go to China and be able to take advantage of low-cost labor. And, of course, what that meant was we had massive job loss in manufacturing in the United States. And this is something that a lot of people, including a lot of economists, who really should know better, they really tend to downplay. So if you look at employment in manufacturing going back to 1970, there's really not all that much change in employment from 1970 to 2000. It's three decades. There's relatively little change in employment. In the 7 years from 2000 to 2007, and I picked 2007 deliberately because that's before the Great Recession, we lost 3.4 million manufacturing jobs. That was 20% of all manufacturing jobs. We lost 40% of unionized jobs in manufacturing. So we took a massive hit in manufacturing employment, and this coincided with this huge increase in the trade deficit in those years. So to my view, there's a very direct story that we outsourced huge numbers of manufacturing jobs because of, you know, the design of trade deals, and the result of that was we lost a large number of good-paying jobs that people were able to support families on, and the jobs that they had to go to replace them in other sectors, in retail or whatever it might be, generally paid much, much less. And, of course, many of these people didn't get reemployed at all. So we saw a huge hit to a very large segment of the working class pretty much as a direct result of our trade policy, and that, to my view, is a really big deal.
Wow, so the three decades before 2000, we didn't see much job loss in manufacturing?
Yeah, and just to be clear, that's aggregate, so that doesn't mean, you know, you didn't lose jobs in one factory and they were picked up in another. I mean, people were always losing jobs, but if you take the total number of manufacturing jobs, we lost, depending exactly what months you choose and everything, but we lost maybe 200,000 or 300,000 jobs out of about 17.5 million over that period.
Wow. So just to repeat this, and this is in Dean's Jacobin piece, which you can find at yourcallradio.org. As a result of the exploding trade deficit, we lost 3.4 million manufacturing jobs just between 2000 and 2007. We lost 40% of all unionized jobs in manufacturing. You point to General Electric, Boeing, Walmart. I mean, is it safe to say that it's just a lot of multinationals decided to close shop here and go overseas for very low labor? They also, in many countries, don't have to abide by many environmental laws.
Yeah, they were looking for the lowest possible cost of production, and that, you know, that meant going overseas in many cases. Here you had workers, you know, and I was emphasizing this, you had workers that were, these were not just manufacturing workers, but unionized manufacturing workers who tend to be higher paid, have health care benefits, pension benefits. These were relatively good jobs. And instead you could get workers in Mexico or China at, you know, in many cases less than a tenth of the cost. So that was a very good deal for these companies. So, again, this wasn't a mistake. That was the point of the trade deals. And, you know, again, to my view, that was very bad for a very large segment of the U.S. population.
And before we go to break, Dean, how do you connect that, the fact that these companies go overseas, and in some cases, when you're talking about shoe manufacturers like Nike, paying mostly women in places like Vietnam, for example, you know, dollars an hour. I mean, they make such incredibly low wages, and yet the shoes still cost more than $100 a pair here in the United States. How is that connected to increased profits and CEO pay?
Well, this was certainly one way in which these companies were able to increase their profits. So from their vantage point, they're looking at two separate questions. How much can you sell the shoe for? So Nike, I'm not personally a Nike buyer for whatever reason, but, you know, whatever. There's clearly demand for their shoes at $150 a pair or whatever it might be. And they stand to profit insofar as they can get those production costs down as low as possible. So if instead of paying workers in the U.S. $25 an hour or whatever it might be to make their shoes, they can get, as you're saying, often women workers in Indonesia or other places, for in many cases a dollar an hour or less, they're going to do that. And that certainly means you're paying less to workers. So there's a lot more money for both corporate profits and also for the higher paid CEOs, who undoubtedly think of themselves as being very clever people for being able to find low cost labor in Indonesia.
Dean Baker is a senior economist at the Center for Economic Policy Research and visiting professor at the University of Utah. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about the real state of the U.S. economy and what we can expect in the next couple of years. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, local public radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. You may leave a comment on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. American farmers are paying the price for Trump's tariffs. That's the topic for 1A with Joshua Johnson on 1A at 11 o'clock, one half hour from now here on KLW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with award-winning filmmaker Rodney Evans about his new film, Vision Portraits, which follows the journeys of four blind and visually impaired artists, including Evans, who only has 20% of his focal vision left. And then on Friday, it's our media roundtable. We will discuss coverage of the ongoing horrific fires in the Amazon rainforest. If you have a show idea or a guest idea or overall feedback, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, please visit yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with Dean Baker, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, visiting professor at the University of Utah. He writes commentary on economic reporting for his Beat the Press blog. His most recent book is called Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And now I would like to introduce Tim Appel to the show. Tim is a reporter for Reuters, where he covers the economy. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So, Tim, we were just getting into talking about trade with Dean Baker, and he was sharing a really important fact that deserves so much more attention. In a piece he wrote for Jacobin, he writes that as a result of the trade deficit, we lost almost 3.5 million manufacturing jobs between 2000 and 2007, 20% of the jobs in the sector. We lost 40% of all unionized jobs in manufacturing. Can you talk a bit about just how that has affected the economy and job prospects?
Sure. The main impact has been on in terms of the workers who have lost jobs. But for the larger economy, I know that the key factor here has been basically to lower the rate of inflation than it would have otherwise been. So this is always a case of sort of uneven harm caused by economic change, but the benefits get spread out in different parts of the economy. And I think one of the key questions now is whether we're sort of paying the price of basically a decade of relatively low inflation for consumer goods that would have normally cost a lot more if they'd been produced in more traditional, you know, factories in the U.S.
And I wonder, have you been able to talk to any Trump supporters who believed that he would turn this around for them. The Washington Post quoted an older man, Rick Quinn, who voted for Trump in Michigan. He said that he used to earn $40 an hour with good benefits at one of the three big auto companies in Detroit. He lost that job at 55. Now he's working as a security guard, making about 10 bucks an hour. He said, "I'm really struggling." He and his wife moved into a smaller house. They're driving cars that are so old that the heat no longer works, which is pretty brutal in a place like Michigan. I mean, we just keep hearing stories about this over and over again. People who voted for Trump because they're struggling so much.
Well, I think that's, I mean, that's definitely what you have seen, and I've heard it in reporting trips, not just in the Midwest, but in a lot of parts of the country. And these are the people that are the ones who are harmed the most directly by the loss of these high-paying jobs. I mean, it's interesting, that example you use. One of the people that I've stayed in touch with is a family which they didn't have an auto industry, auto assembly job, but they worked in an auto parts factory. And, I mean, there are people in the family that earned twice as much 30 years ago as they do today, and the jobs are very different today. The one fellow that I wrote about now works in has an overnight shift in a warehouse, essentially, a distribution center. It's the best job he can get. And so I think you see those kind of stories all across this region, where you've just had a huge sort of displacement of workers from those higher paying jobs, kind of going down the economic ladder into lower paying jobs.
And given that you report on these issues, Tim, we were talking with Dean about where this is going. When you look at the number of people working two or three jobs, the number of older people who are relying solely on Social Security, which, let's say, it's about $1,000 a month on average, a little lower, a little higher for some. I mean, you can't live on that. So, and then you look at millennials, and, you know, they're really struggling. We've heard about millennials who will most likely do worse than their parents. Where do you see this going in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I think that part of the change right now, you've seen this, and I don't think it's a solution at all, but, I mean, part of the kind of shift of focus toward raising the minimum wage and having more of a lower bound on wages has been driven largely by this. You've got places where they've been successful in getting a minimum wage raised to $12, $13, $15 an hour, and that's important because I think people often forget one of the reasons that businesses are so uneasy and unhappy about that is that when Starbucks or Walmart starts paying a much higher minimum wage, it filters out through the whole economy. And if you want to have your person show up at 5 a.m. to work in a factory, you have to pay them a lot more. And so it pushes up the wage scale beyond just the impact at the bottom of the wage scale. So I think that's one of the main things I think is going on right now. And I do hear it from employers, not just manufacturers, but a lot of employers, they complain about the difficulty they have finding workers. What they're really complaining about is the difficulty of finding people at the wage they're willing to pay, and they're having to essentially raise wages for jobs that require some skill or some capabilities beyond just showing up.
Hmm. What are your thoughts about that, Dean? If, let's say, that the federal government increases the minimum wage to 15 bucks an hour, how will that affect the economy and workers?
Well, I think that'd be a very good step. I mean, thankfully, a number of states, New York, California, I believe Illinois, have already laws on the books where their minimum wage is going up to 15 an hour in 2022 or 2024, depending on the state. And I believe the proposals that candidates Bernie Sanders been leading when touting this, but I believe Elizabeth Warren and several of the others have advocated as well, would have a 225, and that would have a big impact. I mean, in a number of states, it's still the federal minimum of 725 an hour. So people seeing their wages rise more than double, again, it's not overnight, of course, but seeing them more than double, that will have a huge impact on their standard of living. Now, I do worry you may see some unemployment in some of these states. So that's something that one has to be cautious about. There's been a lot of research on this, and most of it's pretty encouraging in finding very little evidence of employment fall-offs in response to even fairly large increases in minimum wage. So hopefully that will be the case, but you can never rule out that there will be some, and certainly won't be zero. But in any case, for a lot of people, that's a huge improvement in their standard of living. Now, it doesn't, even $15 an hour isn't, Tim was talking about someone earning $40 an hour 10 or 15 years ago. That's clearly not the same, but it's a big step in the right direction. I mean, one of the points that, you know, I was mentioning before, unionized workers, well, unions are now less than 7% of the private sector labor force. If we can get the unionization rate back up, and again, that's not easy, not something to be done overnight, but we're at around 20% back in 1980. So, of course, if we had something like that today, then a lot more workers would have the bargaining power they need to ensure themselves that they have a decent wage. But again, that's not something that, I'll just say, there's not an easy fix for that.
We have an email from a listener who says, talking about collective employment rates seems to miss important distinctions and may misrepresent the real impact. For example, employment by age, gender, and racial category likely paints a much different picture that could make people behave differently. Anecdotally, this listener writes, I know many in their mid-50s who are no longer looking for work because of age discrimination. Dean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, there are huge demographic differences. African Americans, particularly, it's just easy and important one, you know, that their unemployment rate tends to be twice the white unemployment rate. Older workers actually tend to have a lower unemployment rate. I think it's exactly what this email was pointing to, that a lot of people in their 50s, if they can't find jobs, they drop out of the workforce. But their unemployment rates actually tend to be lower. So just to be clear, the unemployment rate is the percentage of people who say they're looking for employment and can't find it. So if someone's just given up because they've been looking for a year and 2 years, then they're not counted as that. So there are big differences. One of the things I'll just mention, because I just did a short piece on it, I and others have been very encouraged that the Federal Reserve Board under Jerome Powell has made a point of saying, you know, we recognize that our policy affects not just the overall economy, but disproportionately when we talk about the unemployment rate going up or, for that matter, going down, it's those at the bottom of the ladder, people in inner cities, people with criminal records. These are the people who are most affected. And one of the good stories is that as the unemployment rate's fallen to 3.7%, it's still way, way too high for blacks, but that means a black unemployment rate somewhere around 6% as opposed to 8, 9, 10% that we were seeing a few years ago. So, you know, it's, I know, half empty, half full. I mean, I don't know if you want to celebrate a 6% unemployment rate for blacks, but that's certainly much better than 8 or 9%. But yes, there are very large demographic differences, and we really should keep those in mind.
Tim, anything to add on that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the other part of it that is important that I find in places that I report in is the unemployment rate can be quite low in places where there's still a lot of what essentially structural unemployment. People who aren't, and often they are members of minorities or immigrant groups that don't have the skills that are being demanded by a lot of the new kind of employment. Whether it's a more service oriented business that requires lots of language skill and soft skills, I think that there's an issue here of where we're not really preparing, and there aren't the pathways into these jobs for the groups that are at a disadvantage. And I think that's one of the big challenges going forward, is finding ways to do better workforce development.
That is Tim Appel. He is a reporter for Reuters. We're also joined by Dean Baker, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Today, we're talking about the real state of the economy and what's to come. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. There's so much talk right now about the trade war and tariffs. And if there's something that maybe you don't understand or that you've been having a question about, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. So let's talk about tariffs. So back in April, the Trump administration announced a list of over 1,000 Chinese exports, things like medical devices and televisions, that he planned to place tariffs on. And then the next day, China struck back, unveiling its own list of goods that it would place tariffs on. And it keeps going back and forth. Last week, Trump tweeted that he'll raise tariffs on $250 billion worth of Chinese goods to 30% beginning on October 1st. In response, China China said it would increase tariffs on $75 billion worth of goods. Tim, what is going on here? I mean, what is the Trump administration's end game here?
Well, that's a very good question, because I don't know that. I mean, one of the stress points right now for the economy is that it's not clear what the end game is. I mean, a lot of this started, as you said, a year ago with conversations, you know, statements about making a more fair and equitable relationship, but there are some pretty powerful voices within the administration that have some very negative views about China and are talking more about, you know, disengaging our economies, and that's what led to all this discussion last week when the president announced that he was ordering U.S. he was somehow going to order U.S. companies out of China. So I really think there's a couple of different messages, which is really stressful for businesses and should be stressful for consumers, because it's going to cost more if this isn't resolved in some sort of a beneficial way for the U.S.
Dean, what's your read on it? What is the administration doing exactly?
Well, that's a big problem. It's not entirely clear. I was actually sympathetic during the campaign. Donald Trump was running around yelling about China being a currency manipulator. I don't really like the term manipulate, because they have a managed exchange rate, so we don't have to get flashlights out and catch what they're doing in the dark. They have a managed exchange rate, and I would argue that the currency should be higher relative to the dollar. And that would have been the sort of thing that you could have negotiated. We set a target, you discuss it, we do trade-offs, and that's the sort of thing that governments do all the time. But instead, he has kind of a laundry list of complaints against China, and they seem to keep changing. Again, I'm not party to the negotiations, so I don't know exactly what goes on behind closed doors, but what comes out publicly seems to be a continually changing list. And things that, you know, I would say at least most Americans have very little interest in. I don't care if China doesn't respect Boeing's intellectual property. I mean, one of the complaints is if Boeing sets up a factory in China that they're required to take a domestic partner, and they end up transferring technology to that domestic partner who then becomes a competitor with Boeing. Well, that doesn't really bother me. I'm happy to see China develop, and in terms of making it easier for Boeing to outsource, because they don't have to worry about technology transfers, I'm not anxious to do that. So there's a lot of these issues that Trump is raising that certainly the people who voted for him, the workers who thought they'd get better wages or more jobs, they have no interest in that, and it's not clear that, you know, what Trump's demanding there is any hope of getting. So if the end game for Trump is that we have a disengagement with China, again, as Tim was saying, he gave some order. I don't know what he thought he was doing, but he said he tweets, "I hereby order all great companies," or however he put it, "of the United States to begin to disengage from China as quickly as possible." Well, he doesn't really have the authority to do that, but in any case, if that's his goal, it's a very perverse goal and likely to impose very, very large costs on the U.S. And just one more point on that, insofar as there is concern about a recession, it really is very, very directly related to this trade war. Not so much tariff per se. Those are taxes on the U.S. economy. Those come out of people's pockets. Those slow spending, no doubt about that. But it's more the uncertainty. So if you're a company trying to decide, do they want to expand capacity, do they want to build a new factory, it's very hard to make that decision in a context where you don't know what you're going to be paying for your input prices, because invariably a lot of these are imports. So are we going to have a 25% tariff on them? Are you going to be prohibited from getting things from China altogether? And you don't know about your export markets, because maybe China's going to be retaliating and they're going to say, oh, we're not buying anything from the United States. So we're seeing a fall off in investment, and that's almost certainly directly related to the uncertainty associated with the trade war.
Tim, what about farmers and how they've been affected? The New York Times had a piece yesterday that said lucrative contracts that farmers long relied on for a significant source of income have evaporated, with Chinese buyers looking to places like Brazil and Canada to get their commodities. Farm bankruptcy filings in the year through June in the United States were up 13%. From 2018, and loan delinquency rates are on the rise, according to the American Farm Bureau.
Yes, I mean, I think the whole situation with American farming is a wonderful sort of window into this issue, because we think of it as the sort of ultimate heartland U.S. domestic industry, but like everything else, it's incredibly globalized at this point, and the prices of farm commodities. We saw it, there was a story the other day about the export of Maine lobsters has collapsed to China because it was a major market. So a lot of our sort of the way we discuss this misses the the reality of how the economy has already globalized. And I think, you know, what we're discovering now is that, you know, there are a lot of groups that, you know, liked the rhetoric but didn't fully understand what the consequences are of changing our sort of deal with the global economy.
And what about steel? Trump slapped a 25% tariff on steel imports from China last March. And since then, steel stock price has plummeted more than 70%. Last week, this got a lot of attention. U.S. Steel announced that it would, quote, temporarily lay off 200 workers at a Michigan factory. Tim, what does that mean exactly, temporarily lay off?
Well, temporary layoffs at this point for U.S. Steel are probably, at a minimum, very lengthy layoffs, if not permanent, because the reality in the steel market of, in the U.S. is that we have a very vibrant sort of modern steel industry that's developed new technology, and we have a lot of leftover steel production, which is produced using an older technology that really is not competitive in the same sense of the rest of the industry. So, I mean, the tariffs initially drove up steel prices, and that was better for everyone. And U.S. Steel famously restarted a mill in Granite City, Illinois, that had been shut down, pointing to the tariffs and the benefits of higher prices. But we're now seeing the downside of that, which is that those higher prices brought about a surge of investment in this newer technology, and also once prices go high enough, even tariffs on imports become irrelevant because imports then are able to compete. So it creates sort of a roller coaster in the steel industry, which has now kind of brought us back to the point where U.S. Steel is laying off people. They've shut down two blast furnaces, and the assumption of most people that are experts in that industry is that this is going to be a prolonged downturn for the domestic steel industry. So it's really was a sort of a short-lived sugar high that is gone now.
And for people who are struggling to make ends meet and are concerned about the price of basic items going up, Dean, what goods are being hit or will likely be hit the hardest by this new wave of tariffs?
Well, Trump's really, it's a little hard to say, Ben, and so if he carries through with the full set of tariffs, because he has been going back and forth, and he did announce a delay because originally it was supposed to hit September 1st. Now I think he's talking December 1st. But he's really hitting a very, very wide range of imported goods. So this is clothes, shoes, a wide range of appliances. So people are likely to see some hit. And one of the points to keep in mind, and ordinarily this is part of the purpose of tariffs, you're increasing not just the price of imports, but you're increasing the price of domestic goods that compete with them. So if the shirt that we're importing from China goes up, I forget whether we're talking 10% or 25% now, but whichever the tariff that they're hit by, odds are the shirts that are made in the U.S. or for that matter imported from other countries, those won't go up quite as much, but those prices are likely to also rise because they'll realize that their importers are hit with this tariff. So we're likely to see prices rise on a wide range of goods, and just, you know, some simple arithmetic, 10% tariffs on $300 billion, that's $30 billion a year. That's equivalent to a $30 billion a year tax increase. I mean, that's not going to destroy the economy, but that will be a noticeable effect.
We have an email from Patrick who says, we need more real economic news in addition to the Dow or the profits. I can't see what he's saying here. Down profit notice we see daily. I'm thinking Dow. How can we demand more of this kind of real economic news, Dean?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, one of the things is to get reporting to downplay the stock market. But I will say, and again, I've been following reporting on economic issues very closely for more than a quarter century, I think it has gotten a lot better. Now, I read the New York Times. I don't know if everyone does that. No, I shouldn't say I don't know. I know everyone does not do that. Washington Post. But, you know, these have gotten better. And One of the things that, you know, smaller papers could do, they can subscribe. All these you know, most of these reports are on news services. So I know that could be expensive for a smaller paper, but I mean, that's smaller papers can't hire a lot of economics reporters, so you can't expect the Des Moines Register or the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, not to knock the papers, but they just aren't that big papers. They can't have a whole lot of economic reporters. What they can do is subscribe to good economic reporters that the New York Times has or other news services.
And what are your thoughts on this, Tim? As Dean says, what we're dealing with right now did not happen by accident. I mean, this happened because of policies from both Republican and Democratic administrations. So how do you weave that into your reporting about these issues?
Well, I mean, it's one of the key things about economic coverage in general, and I think we've already you already touched on that, that, you know, maybe there's a dissatisfaction with it, but I think what we need more of is economic reporting that doesn't just rely on data, which is a very limited kind of window, and actually goes out and frames out those stories with what is really happening. For instance, the example I gave of, you know, there are places in the Midwest with very low unemployment rates, but where average wages have fallen dramatically and where basically the living standards have fallen dramatically. So I think that's the kind of thing that good reporting can bring to bear and is important for people who want to understand exactly, you know, why there might be dissatisfaction in a state far away that you're not that familiar with, but suddenly, you know, what's going on in Ohio or, you know, Wisconsin. I think reporting of the right type can bring that to light.
Tim Appel is a reporter for Reuters, and you can find his pieces at yourcallradio.org. Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dean Baker is senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, visiting professor at the University of Utah, and you can check out the blog that he writes. It's Commentary on Economic Reporting, Beat the Press, and a link to that is at yourcallradio.org. Dean, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with award-winning filmmaker Rodney Evans about his new film, Vision Portraits. It follows the journeys of four blind and visually impaired artists, including Evans, who only has 20% of his focal vision left due to a rare genetic eye disorder. He says losing his vision made him a better director. So what can we learn from visually impaired artists about the creative process? That is tomorrow. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. If you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can find it at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.